I call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. A quorum is or was present. Chair, as first order of business, would entertain a motion to approve the minutes from February 17th. Representative Johnson moves their approval. Any discussion or additions, corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of their adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Representative Hillstrom. Thank you for your patience and welcome back to the committee. Representative Hillstrom, the chair will move that House File 2798 be recommended to pass and be returned to the Committee on Finance. Representative Hillstrom, do you have any opening remarks for the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for moving the bill. I believe that there's going to be an amendment, and if it is the chair's wishes, I believe Representative Atkins has it.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move the A8 amendment.
Representative Atkins moves the A8 amendment. Discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that the A8 amendment was distributed, should be at the top of everybody's folders. There is, and I ran this by, or with the help of Mr. Aleph, the chief author, in the AG's folks, there is an oral change that I'd like to incorporate, and that is on line 1.24, after the word the, insert the words same annual, and then on line 1.25, remove the words per month. And as soon as I see people's pen stop scribbling madly, that will then allow for a interest which shall on it. I'll just read it through in terms of what the actual amendment is, just in case people aren't following it. But starting on line 1.24, it says interest on it which shall accrue monthly at the same annual rate of interest charged by the utility on delinquent accounts under Minnesota Rules Part 7820. Calculated from the effective date of the interim rate increase until the excess amount collected under interim rates is fully funded. That is
Representative Atkins, would you like to put that in English now?
Mr. Chairman, I read it, and yes, I would endeavor to try to put it in plain English. What it means is that interim rates under this amendment would still be allowed, but in the event there was an overpayment and the refund that was necessary at the end, and let's use real numbers. Let's say that the average person is going to get $15 back, which is what the utilities have told me. Right now, they get it back at the interest rate, which is calculated, the prime interest rate, which is a couple percent. What this amendment would provide for would be that the interest rate that the utility would pay would actually be what they charge their customers who are in arrears, who are delinquent on their bills. So there's a certain symmetry between the two. It would be an incentive to not overcharge. And most of the utilities that have come wandering by and seen us have said the average refund is $13 to $15. So the at this interest rate, it might be a dollar more or something along those lines. With that, I would move it. I have discussed it with the chief author and others, and would be happy to entertain whatever questions or people or concerns that people may have.
Have the amendment before us, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, of course, I prefer my bill as was introduced, the interim rate issue. However, I do know how to count, and I do not have the votes on this committee. Just know that this won't be the last that you'll see this issue, but I have spoken with Representative Atkins, and I think that at least if the utilities are going to continue to be able to make this charge, they should have to pay the same interest rate they charge their ratepayers. This puts this in their control. If they don't want to pay a higher rate of interest rate, they can charge their ratepayers less. And with that, Mr. Chair, I do know that that Representative Adkins has talked with me, and encourage you to vote for it.
Further discussion to the amendment? Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to go on record saying that I have some concerns, continue to have the same concerns that I expressed last week about moving forward with this provision without having full discussion about the ramifications with our utilities and with the PUC. I appreciate Representative Atkins's work to find something that we could move forward. I don't know that we're ready to. I don't know that this actually solves the problem on a global scale, or if it makes it worse or better. So I still have a lot of reservations. I don't know if we'll hear from folks before we pass the bill or the amendment. Or take the vote, but just wanted to go on record with those reservations still.
Further discussion to the amendment? Is there anyone present that wishes to testify for or against the amendment? Clark, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Yeah. My name is Chris Clark. I'm an in-house attorney with Xcel Energy.
Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. On behalf of Xcel Energy, we appreciate the efforts of legislators to move this issue towards a compromise. However, we still have concerns with this new amendment as proposed. In particular, our concern would be that the payment rate of interest on interim rate refunds is really a totally separate matter than the payment of the interest rate by our ratepayers when they're in arrears with us. The two are really designed to do two different things, and while we appreciate the attempt to provide some symmetry and an incentive for a utility to get their interim rate levels correct, we think this continues to send the wrong message about the structure and really needs to be looked at as part of an overall review of the regulatory process. In particular, the late payment fees have been set really to do several things. One, to encourage people to pay on time, and two, to reduce the amount of arrears that we have from customers who pay late or choose not to pay at all. Customers who don't pay their utilities at all increase the amount of bad debt, which increases the cost of utility service to all customers. That amount gets wrapped back into the rate case process. So the higher interest rate level is designed to give ratepayers an incentive to make their payments and make them on time. Additionally, we found when the rate was much lower for our late payments, ratepayers would put the utility bill at the bottom of the stack and not give it the attention it needs. Our preference is to send a message to customers that they need to deal with this issue, and what we really want them to do is to call us and work out a payment plan. Once we work out a payment plan with customers, for instance, at our utility, going forward, as long as they're following that payment plan, we waive the late payment interest rate penalties, so that we're trying to encourage customers to work with us. And I tell you this for two reasons. One, I want you to understand the difference between what we do on the late payment side and what we do on the interim rate side. And number two, because I want you to know that our goal here is to work with customers to find solutions to help them. Our concern is that if you continue down the path that this amendment would go, we're really not doing anything to help those customers who need help in paying their utility bills. All we're doing is playing with the structure of utility rate regulation, and again, we think that's something that you should look at in a broader picture. Appreciate the opportunity to speak on the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Clark? Mr. Clark, thank you for your testimony, and I think you mentioned to begin with that this amendment does, whether it's a major intention or not, I hope that it is, it does incentivize the utilities to try to get the interim rates right to begin with. Would you agree that to the degree that you were able to do that, that this amendment really would not even apply to you?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the challenge is that rate cases are a very complex review of our business. They look at every single cost that we propose in that test year and that representative year of costs. And the process is designed to have some adversarial back and forth. What we file is tested, and while we believe very strongly that we can make the case on each one of those points, the process lends itself to that adversarial testing and then encourages settlement, which brings the cost down typically. I think when you start putting mechanisms like this in place, it provides an incentive to litigate more issues to the end. It provides us a disincentive to resolve issues, and I think it starts to put road bumps in a process that has worked very well for the state. So that's our concern with it.
Thank you. Representative Gunther?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If a utility loses money because of an interim rate, they can only recover 1 month of that loss. And if they lose money for 17 months, and it's a substantial amount of money, causing that utility to be in jeopardy of being able to function, is there any relief they get from the PUC or anybody else in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Clark?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if the interim rates ends up being lower than what final rates are set, the utility will simply be out that money, and that puts financial pressure on the utility. You won't have that money to spend. You won't, even though the Utilities Commission has found that it's a necessary cost of doing business,
you betcha,
you won't have had those funds during that period to be able to support your business. You're simply out it, which sends a negative message to those who invest in the utility and typically causes things like the utility to experience higher interest rates when it goes to the debt markets to access short-term debt.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Jackson.
I'm wondering, though, how often, I mean, how many cases can you cite in, say, the past 10 years where the rate increase set by the PUC was actually higher than that which was requested?
Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure that I can name any. I don't think that that's a sign that the process doesn't work. We're the only party that's has an incentive to bring in the request for what we think is the total amount we need. Every other party to the rate case forum has an incentive to move that level down because they get a lower rate. And so there are issues in the case where we will adjust for costs that have moved up and down during, because as you saw in that timeline, the case proceeds over a significant period of time, and there are cost factors built into that test year that we all recognize are moving up and down. And the parties in Minnesota have been very good about adjusting appropriately for those that have gone up and those that have gone down, but the total picture always ends up becoming less than what the utility filed.
Further discussion. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Clark, one of the concerns that we've heard is the changing the interim rate process or interim rate presumptions and structure could result in a tougher capital access climate, thus actually sort of being counterintuitively raising rates by making it harder and more expensive to invest in the projects that we've mandated through other portions of our statute. Are you aware of, some of us have been trying to track down whether there are states where, not necessarily this change, but some change in rate structure or in regulatory or energy policy has resulted in tougher capital or even in divestment or lower levels of investment, thus slowing down energy policy and or raising bills or rates.
Mr. Clark?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think probably the example that comes to mind is what's happened to Florida Power and Light with its regulators in Florida, where they just had, were dealt a significant blow in the rate case and took a bunch of capital spending offline. I hesitate to use that example because I think that a big decision like that reflects sort of years of tension between utilities, regulators, and other stakeholders in the process. And I think we've been very fortunate in Minnesota to have a constructive regulatory process, yet one that provides significant scrutiny over utility investment. We really have been able to accomplish a lot here in Minnesota, and I think we've stepped out ahead of many other states in renewable energy, in dedicating funds to our nuclear and other infrastructure. And so I think we're well positioned, but I do think you have to be careful as you move the pieces of the regulatory picture around, because it makes the investors nervous, and those are the people we have to go get the money from. And while I recognize that's not a crowd that we all have a lot of sympathy for, it's the reality of big capital investments like we undertake. The other thing I would say in response to your question is I believe a lot of states are actually looking towards Minnesota's model of how can they combine the tools of rate cases, riders, and mechanisms like we've done on the conservation spending that send the right message to utilities, try to align the state's policy goal interest with that of the utilities, while at the same time making sure that ratepayers retain reasonable rates.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Clark.
Thank you.
We have the A8 amendment before us. Is there further discussion to the amendment? Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, before we vote on this, wanted to say that I liked the bill in its original form, and I don't know what's going to happen with the amendment going on, but I do think members should keep in mind that allowing a monopoly to exist in the marketplace is a unique situation for government. Normally, we act to prevent monopolies. And so where we have allowed monopolies to exist by law, there's a high burden on those of us who oversee the monopolies to protect consumers. And that's why I like the previous draft better.
Further discussion? Representative Breiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm weighing in cautiously here because this is a very complex discussion, but that's exactly one of my concerns, is that an amendment like this has implications that I don't think we've had the opportunity to weigh out, and I really believe in open stakeholder process, and I think the precisely because of Representative Hortman's comments on the situation in Minnesota with utilities as monopolies, I think it's all the more imperative that we have an open stakeholder process and a hearing. And so I'm uncomfortable with both the amendment and the bill for the lack of a longer, more evolved open stakeholder process.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Atkins will renew his motion that the A8 amendment be adopted. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Chair is in doubt. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? Our counters had to confer on their methods of counting and have reached an agreement. There being 9 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We had a number of people on the list to testify on the bill. I think maybe in light of the adoption of the amendment, which basically leaves the interim rate process itself intact, some may wish to alter or forego their testimony. But we will ask in the order that we have them on the agenda, Ms. Hinkle.
Mr. Chair, and I apologize, Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Annette Hinkle with the Minnesota Utility Investors, but my understanding is that the interim rate piece is still in track. You're just changing the interest rate. Was that the...
Ms. Schenkel, that's correct. Yes.
I just wanted to make sure that I understood that. But we do, Mr. Chair and members, we do still have some serious concerns with this legislation, and we do see this bill as two very separate pieces of, in two very separate different parts. You've heard a lot of testimony. You've had some talk this morning as well about the interim rates. It is a very complicated and highly regulated process. But what I would like to do just very briefly today is put a face on the people that will be significantly harmed by this portion of the proposed legislation, and that is our members. Most of you know our members. They're not the Wall Street big-time investors. Our members are predominantly older, retired folks that have invested in these Minnesota utility companies. Our members rely upon the dividends that these companies provide for much of their retirement, much of their livelihood in their retirement. And these are the people who we feel are going to be harmed by this portion of the legislation. Our MUI members do believe that eliminating or almost eliminating interim rates will make it harder and more expensive for the utilities to attract capital to provide service, which does affect their bottom line, which will impact the value of their company, as well as we've talked in the long term, negatively impacting ratepayers. So our members are getting hit twice, as ratepayers and as shareholders. And you heard a very real example of this last week with Minnesota Power with the Public Utilities Commission decision. In December, the PUC reduced Minnesota Power's interim rates by 40%. Within hours of that decision, Minnesota Power Elite stock price dropped 4%. Within 3 days, $75 million of its market value was lost. It's a very real situation, had some very serious ramifications for the company and for my members. Very briefly, turning to the expense portion of this bill, our members are ratepayers too, and we do want and demand in transparency and expenses. We just want to make sure that the information that utilities have to provide is usable and in a format that is helpful. But we do not believe that the interim rate provision is ready to move forward. And I would again encourage the committee to recognize the potentially severe ramifications that these provisions would have on our members. The committee determines reforms are needed when we encourage you to look at the broader regulatory process rather than piecemeal, and to hold off moving the interim rate portion forward. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Ms. Hinkle? Seeing none, thank you. have Mr. Larson on the list. Mr. Larson, do you wish to testify?
Good afternoon, Chair Hilty and members of the Commission. I'm Doug Larson with Dakota Electric. Dakota Electric is a member-owned electric distribution cooperative. We're not for profit. We're governed by an elected board of directors, and we are the only rate-regulated electric cooperative in the state of Minnesota. So I'd like to speak on behalf of kind of our unique status as a rate-regulated cooperative, specifically related to both the interim rate provision and the discussion of travel entertainment expense part of this bill. Looking at interim rates, Dakota Electric has a history of delaying our rate cases as long as we absolutely can. And by that, what I mean is we usually don't file a rate increase until we have had or are about to have a year of negative operating margins. So, and we're able to do that with our organizational structure and the relationship with our lender. This is much different than the investor-owned utilities find themselves in. They can't wait as long to file a rate increase is what we're able to. And we do this by carefully reviewing our financial position and the timing of this rate case filing. When we find it's necessary to file a general rate case, it's our board of directors who are elected by our members that authorize us to submit the filing to the Public Utilities Commission. We do have a history of receiving nearly all of the increase that we request, in large part because we're very conservative in what we ask for. Another issue that kind of relates to this, the interim rate provision, is the statutory provision for how long it takes to complete a general rate case. There is a provision that specifies 10 months as the time frame, but we know the Commission does have the discretion to extend that timeline, and in fact, right now we're in the midst of a general rate case, and that case will take us approximately 16 months to complete. And that's why relying on interim rates is crucial to the timing of our filings when we look at both the need to collect revenue when we're at or about to have negative operating margins, as well as just the length of time it takes to complete this process. Now, we recognize that the present bill language does allow for interim rates if there's a compelling necessity. And we've talked with the bill's author. We certainly recognize and appreciate the provision that's in the bill, but from our point of view, it doesn't really provide that same level of certainty of knowing that we get interim rates, which for us, the bottom line, would affect the timing of our filing for a rate case.
Mr. Larson, you're aware that the bill as amended leaves the interim rate structure intact.
Okay. Moving on then, looking at travel and entertainment expenses, we certainly support open disclosure of expenses. In fact, when I explained this provision to our board before I could finish describing it, the board very quickly said, well, we've got nothing to hide. We'll show whatever the expenses are. I can tell you from my point of view, I do have a concern just about the administrative burden of identifying all of the expenses that are potentially listed there. Dakota Electric, we're a small utility, and extracting that level of detail from our accounting system could be quite a burden. And in addition to that, there'd be just simply a mountain of information for state agency staff to be reviewing. Certainly what we would encourage is some discussion that might bring focus to that, specifically if the presumption is that the real concern is the spending level of upper level management or directors, that could be one way to focus this. Right now, the way the bill is written, as we would interpret it, this would apply to our rank and file employees as well. So, for example, line workers that are working overtime to restore an outage, we have a provision that allows them to get meal reimbursement. We would have to report all of that reimbursement, keep track of that, and report that. And another issue that we look at is it talks about a 2 years' worth of information being filed Certainly, if that were limited to the most recent 12 months, like we would do for a test year for a rate case, that could kind of help control just that volume of information. And those are my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Any questions for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you. Members, we have Director Guan on the agenda. I think he has indicated that he's present and willing to answer questions, but does not, in light of the adoption of the amendment, feel a necessity of testifying on the bill. If anyone wants to call him down here, you're welcome to do that. But in the meantime, Ms. Marshall. Marshall, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Pam Marshall with the Energy Sense Coalition. Our organization advocates on behalf of low and fixed income utility consumers, and that work includes participating in utility rate proceedings. I understand the interim rate provision in current statute is remains for now. I did just want to offer an idea as this discussion, though, evolves further, and that is, I agree with the speakers who have said that provision pretty adequately balances the interests of ratepayers and shareholders, but that's typically because interim rate increases represent about 3 to 4% increases over the utilities' current rates. It's when those general rate increases are in the double digits and interim rate increases are in the double digits that I think the current statute doesn't work as well. So one potential compromise, because I think this could be a narrow fix, is to consider limiting interim rate increases to 10% over the utility's current rates, and in that respect, then it wouldn't just be allowing without any scrutiny whatsoever double-digit increases. To me, that makes some sense. It also makes some sense to define exigent circumstances in a way that could have somewhat of an economic hardship indicator and or a timing issue between utility rate cases. But I offer that for future discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Marshall, Representative Galen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on a question that Representative Welty asked last week, if interim rates are typically about 3 or 4% of the total bill, and we're talking about a reduction of one-third from interim rates to final rate increases, final rate cases, which is the area data that the Attorney General's office brought forward. So we're talking about a 1% or 1.5% average per bill. Now, I understand that's still 1.5% or 1% on our bill, but I'm still wondering whether we're not trying to solve a small problem and making a bigger one.
Marshall?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kalin, it's my understanding, though, that the interim rates that are typically 3 to 4%, that is 3 to 4% over the utility's current rates, and then final rates can be higher than that. So it's when the interim rates themselves are double digit that I think causes some of the problem with the statute as it is.
Mr. Chair, just a quick point. My understanding is that final rates are never higher than the interim rates, and it's this question of how much are they on average ratcheted down, and that doing just this one-third of 3% is 1%. And I just, as a consumer advocate, I very much respect and appreciate the work that you do, because it's really important to have that voice at the table during this process. My fear is that we may be making your work more difficult by leaving Section 1 in, even amended.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative
Marshall,
again, when those interim rate increases are in the 3 to 4% range, we don't have the resources or aren't interested in basically, having a rate case on top of a rate case, essentially. And I'm not sure about, haven't seen the exact data that's been discussed here, but in my experience in the rate cases, the interim rate requests are, it could go either way. The only issue I was trying to address was when that interim rate represents a 10% or more increase over the utility's current rates, that's when this statute as is might not be as effective as it has been in balancing those interests.
Further questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Marshall. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I just might make two clarifications. One is that the information we're requesting is only needed to be produced if the costs are being sought for reimbursement. So if the utility is not seeking reimbursement for the amount, they don't have to disclose it. And the other thing that this does is it decreases the burden on regulators because the information will be presented. So with the stretched staff and budgets, this will actually make it much easier to find the information.
Representative Welty?
Not to this.
Members, we had in our packets from last week a number of amendments that were presented by Representative Falk, and the conversation that I've had with him since then, I think we have agreed that while the issues that he raises may be legitimate issues, they probably are more appropriately dealt with as a bill that is introduced and heard before the committee rather than simply as an amendment to another bill. I did offer Representative Falk the opportunity to address those amendments briefly, but I believe our understanding is that we would not be acting on any of those today. Representative Falk, if you want to address the issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just want to give people the opportunity to look at these in the process. But I do think that we have the opportunity here for some discussion. And I won't move the amendment, but if people would like to look at the A2, just to start raising awareness about some of the compensation of our for-profit utilities, and not asking ratepayers to bear that full burden, but looking at shareholders to bear some of that burden as well. So I think it's a discussion that we should have at a point in this committee.
And I believe that Mr. Keck from Otter Tail Power is here and had wished to testify on this. Mr. Keck, do you still wish to do so?
No.
Welcome to the committee.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I will only briefly on this potential amendment.
And before you begin, would you please identify yourself for the record?
Yes, I will. My name is George Keck. I am the general counsel of Otter Tail Corporation, the parent company of Otter Tail Power Company.
Please proceed.
I have only brief comments on this particular amendment, particularly in light of its status before the committee today. I think one of the things that's very important for this state and for its ratepayers and for its utilities is that the utilities be able to recruit the best available talent to lead the utilities that are in this state and are responding to the numerous challenges that the utilities face. They recruit that talent from a national pool, not a local pool. And what attracts an individual to be a utility executive is different from what attracts an individual to be a governor. There are very different rewards that apply to those jobs. And so drawing a comparison, I think, between a governor's salary and compensation and a utility executive's salary and compensation, I think is misplaced. And I think the second thing to recall is that in our rate process and in our regulatory process, to the extent that the salary and benefits provided to a particular utility executive are deemed not to be reasonable, the commission already has the power to act upon that. And that's all I really have to say on that provision.
Mr. Keck, are you aware of any CEO of a utility that has decided to run for president?
Not that I'm aware of.
Representative Falk, did you like to respond?
Mr. Chair, I guess my only comment to your testimony would be that we're not precluding or disallowing utilities to search for that exceptional talent. We're simply bringing forward the idea that ratepayers would only be on the hook for a portion of it. Shareholders are able to pay as much as they feel is relevant to retain that talent. And I think that would be something that is fair, because if the shareholders are expecting that talent to bring them greater wealth, I think it's all right to consider that they be the ones that are footing that initial bill or footing the compensation above what we might find to be excessive for the ratepayers to be paying. Now, what the number is, I am open to discussion, but I do think that there is a point where for-profit utilities can ask their shareholders to bear some of the burden of executive compensation.
Mr. Keck, did you wish to respond?
No, I won't today.
Any members have any questions for this witness? Seeing none. Oh, Representative Norris?
Quick question, I guess. If this were to pass, Representative Falk, would Minnesota be sort of an island, or would we be the only state that has this requirement?
Representative Falk?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norris, I am not sure. I guess I would have to entertain counsel to look at what other states are doing as well.
Mr. Keck, thank you. Representative Falk, did you have anything further at this time?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe we'll be looking at this issue again at a later date.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify further for or against this bill as amended? Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, before we move to a vote, I do have a couple of questions for the AG's office on the section that remains, particularly concerning the expensing of aviation departments and how they want to proceed with that. While they're coming, perhaps I can refer members to a handout that I made for you over the weekend. This is actually from a gentleman whose specialty is scrutinizing corporate travel, particularly valuable people with valuable talent and time that make the world go around. In the interest of full disclosure, he actually did work for Xcel Energy at one time, so he's pretty familiar with the flight department and how things work. But first of all, let me say this. When it comes to the public rate-making process, full disclosure is a good thing. Transparency is good. There's no argument with transparency here. I guess my truck with the whole thing is how much transparency and at what cost and to what public purpose. That's one concern. And the collateral damage we're doing to our corporate flight departments is a second concern, because of the sensational sexiness that apparently some of us find or some people can't help themselves with when it comes to looking at what big business people do to stay competitive and to make money. A few moments ago, Representative Hortman made a very astute observation. We have granted, over the last century, government-sanctioned monopolies, distinct service areas in which companies operate, at the behest of the public good, and we allow them to organize themselves as public corporations with shareholders and so on. Over the years, these have become very attractive investments for people that rely on a couple of things: dependability, profitability, and stability. Usually retiree programs, teachers, school districts, just individual investors that depend on that dividend payment that comes pretty regularly, which is one reason the PUC has always been pretty measured in its response, making sure that there's a rate of return, making sure that these utilities, which operate in a monopoly and at our behest, can actually perform the services that we require them to perform by law. Now, when these monopolies cross state lines like Xcel Energy does, and I'm not carrying water for Xcel Energy here, I'm talking about good business practice. I'm talking about best practices. When they cross state lines, then, of course, we have an interest in knowing how much of their expenses get allocated to Minnesota. Now, to the attorneys general up here, you're aware of how Xcel operates their expense account program. There's apparently about an 8-digit code that gets attached to everything from a Perkins coupon that a line crew puts out if they have an outage at 3 o'clock in the morning, to, for instance, a couple of sales engineers flying to Colorado because they're working on a coal gasification plant. We're trying to integrate a wind program into the grid out there. This talent, you don't want to duplicate. You're with me on this. If it's not necessary to duplicate the talent in Denver and Amarillo, oh, by the way, we keep forgetting Amarillo here, and Minneapolis, doesn't it make sense to find the most efficient and productive way to move that talent around to do its job? And so I'm wondering how in the world you're going to classify the expenses that you're going to look at through this, what's left of the bill here, particularly when you take a look at the report that I just handed out on how the real flight departments operate and how the airlines interface with the flight departments and how they supplement the corporate travel, particularly when there's an important demand that pops up tomorrow morning that we didn't know about this morning. Who's going to be the final arbiter of whether a trip is necessary or could have been made better if it had been had a 14-day advance purchase for $69 or something? It may be a rhetorical question. You're free to comment on it if you wish.
Thank you, Chair Hilty. Bill Stamets with the Office of the Attorney General. Representative Beard, I think you, in your comments there, you hit the nail on the head that this bill is merely a disclosure requirement. And it does not prejudge any of the expenses that a utility may incur. The Public Utilities Commission is the ultimate decision maker here. They will look at what has been put out, what has been disclosed, and they will decide how much, if any, of these expenses shall be paid by ratepayers. The disclosure allows that information to be put out there, and then all parties can comment on what the party's position is on what a just and reasonable amount of utility expenses should be passed on to ratepayers. With your comments to corporate aviation, for instance, the commission has in a prior order in 2007 with Minnesota Power, Elite, said if you want to recover corporate aircraft costs, you need to provide a cost-benefit analysis in your next rate case to demonstrate that these are indeed reasonable and necessary for the provision of utility service. Now, in that rate case, there was some dispute on whether they provided enough evidence in order to show that these were indeed, this aviation expense was reasonable and necessary for the provision of utility services. And that is the debate that will happen. This bill, this legislation, is the vehicle that will put that information out there so that we can have the debate at the commission.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stamets, my contention is this already exists. What I fear is that we are responding to an investigative news report that all of a sudden seemed to have some legs out there, and now we're going to draft a bill around it to a problem that doesn't, it's a solution looking for a problem. That's what I'm trying to say here. In the 2008 rate case that Xcel just had with you, you went through the entire flight department and all of their expenses and indeed flagged a couple that needed to be flagged. The questions about the trip to Europe, for instance. The executive stayed in a 5-star hotel somewhere and claimed only $600 and some of a $9,000 bill. By the way, have you ever stayed in a 5-star hotel in Hong Kong? $1,100 a night for a crappy room, let me tell you. It's not like Minneapolis. You know you're not in Kansas when you go to Europe and stay in a hotel like that. But the judgment call that comes with it, they get that at the PUC now, and I'm trying to understand what further public purpose is served by doing this. The cost-benefit analysis you talked about, just for grins, I checked on what it would be to send an Excel employee to Denver by Greyhound. $79 one way. Way cheaper than the corporate airplane, way cheaper than a walk-up ticket at Delta Airlines, which is almost $900 if you walk up there this afternoon. You can walk up to the counter, actually, at Greyhound and buy it for $97 on a walk-up. However, it's 19 hours and a bus change in Des Moines. Is that a prudent use of company time, company assets? Probably not. I think I'm making my point and over-making my point here, so I'm going to stop talking about this now. But I just wanted you to know, when you start monkeying with the way people dispatch their assets, and this talent is an asset that's working on our behalf, you start to send a pretty clear message to people that are thinking about doing business in Minnesota that, man, maybe we've just got too many people up here with too much time on our hands looking to stir the pot for stuff that's already available to us in the public record at the PUC, at the Commerce Department, and at the AG's office. To close my thoughts, agreeing with Representative Hortman, we have a government-sanctioned monopoly, which means that these critters that we've created have no natural occurring enemies out there in the form of competition to counterbalance what they do. If a cell phone company treated you this way, you'd just pick up and find another cell phone company. The free market has a way of evening those things out and making us behave. Conversely, because there is a naturally or government-sanctioned monopoly and no natural defense mechanism, we're it. The things we afflict these people with pass through very quickly to the consumers. So when we pass a mercury reduction plan or a wind energy mandate or a biomass mandate or take your pick of one of a host of things we've done just in the 7 short years I've been here, those things go straight through to the ratepayers in a very rapid fashion with very little restraint from competitive forms of business. No competitor. I can't call Dakota Energy and do business with them. I have to take my energy from the territory that I live in. So members, I'm going to caution us to be very careful. Before we kick over this can and afflict our ratepayers with more costs, know that there is no naturally occurring defense mechanism to protect the ratepayers from us. We're it. I see no need to vote yes on the bill, Mr. Chairman. I'd ask us to vote no. Thank you.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a question for the witnesses, but I was reading over what you handed out here, Representative Beard. I just can't help but comment a little bit. I'm not sure the last time a Learjet landed in Bemidji, but it's been a while, I think.
It's probably 3 o'clock this afternoon, actually.
I'm looking at some of these numbers, and I know, you know, the average salary around my district is in the $20,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And I look at what this fella put together here. We got four employees, $1,200 per hour pay rate, $300 an hour, $624,000 a year. And they're flying on Valentine's Day, and I just, you know, if that's not a sweetheart deal, I don't know what is. I think the ratepayers need to know that.
Mm-hmm. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this isn't to the testifiers either. This is just in the context of the bill as I look at it as amended. And, you know, I understand that Representative Atkins was trying to help and trying to come up with some sort of solution on the interim rate. But ever since this bill came up and I've been talking to those involved, I've come to the conclusion that the interim rate itself is necessary. It may need some tweaking. There may need to be some provisions within it that could be addressed individually, but I don't think that the fix, as we have made it with the amendment, is the correct way to go either. I do agree with Section 2. I think we should leave it in there. I do think that it's good to have disclosure of these numbers so that the members of the utility, that the shareholders have access to that information, and they can determine those costs and if they're necessary, and maybe come up with a better business plan based upon that disclosure. But in the case of the interim rate, as we've fixed it, I do have to agree with the testifier that came up from, I believe it was Xcel Energy, when he was talking about not tying two different things together and saying that they should be treated the same. And as I look at it, and Representative Atkins, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but as I read it, what we're saying is that the same interest rate charged to someone for not paying their bill on time, that's the same interest rate that we're also going to pay out in the case of the interim rate if we've overcollected. Am I correct on that?
Yes.
And Representative Atkins, I would have to respectfully disagree with you and thinking that those two should be tied together. I do think that businesses, in the case of delinquent accounts, they have to take into account how that's affecting their bottom line. They have to take into account what the ultimate cost is going to be for their business and then set that rate accordingly. You could argue whether or not that an individual business is setting it higher than it needs to be, but I think we could address that separately than what this amendment does. And so therefore, members, I'm going to offer that we delete Section 1 of the bill. So I move to delete Section 1 of House File 2798 as amended, so that we simply leave in Section 2, which is the full public disclosure of those items that are listed. So that's my offer.
Everyone understands the motion, I presume. It's pretty straightforward. Discussion to the motion, Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, I would like to maintain as much of my bill as I can. Members, it's clear that utilities and the burden on utilities have become more and more of a burden to our residents. And frankly, utilities have no incentive to only take the amount of money that they need. $68 million in overcharges, and your ratepayers paid interest on money that then they ultimately didn't even own. They didn't even owe. So I think it's only fair, Mr. Chair, and I would encourage you to vote to keep it in the bill.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to speak on behalf of Representative Welty's motion to eliminate Section 1. I think it's clear from the discussions we've had up to this point that there is an issue about interim rates, but I also think it's clear that it needs to be more fully vetted, and I would just think we'll get a better result than we get in an amendment that we haven't had a hearing on until today. And I guess in that, on behalf of that position, I'd like to ask Representative Kalin to speak to work he's already doing on behalf of rate protection, ratepayer protection, and how the interim rate review is included in his proposal. But I support Representative Welty's motion.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Briner, as we have talked informally about this bill, with Representative Hillstrom, I've made the commitment that the Ratepayer Protection Act that Mr. Eliff and I are exchanging drafts on and hope to have introduced soon, that this issue will be revisited. I think I'd like to talk with Representative Hillstrom, the Attorney General's office, on the best form or another form to bring the language into to that larger bill. But I think that we need to have this, we need to align our energy policy and our regulatory policy with a full awareness of the unintended consequences. I don't think that it would be wise for us to rush to any one solution, but to do this as far as a more comprehensive picture. I do appreciate Representative Hillstrom for bringing the issue forward, both on the transparency side and the interim rate side. I think we should continue to have that discussion in this committee. but I will be supporting Representative Welty's motion so that we can give it more time.
Further discussion to the amendment, the Welty amendment. That motion then is before us. All those in favor of the Welty amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
No. Again, the chair is in doubt. Those in favor of the amendment, please raise your hand. The amendment is clearly adopted. Presuming there is no further discussion to the bill as amended, the chair will renew his motion that House File 2798 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill, as amended, is passed to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, members.
Representative Hellstrom, thank you. Members, on Wednesday, we will be doing a run-through with the Department of Commerce and the Governor's budget recommendations. Being no further business before the committee at this time, this meeting is adjourned.